Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
En Camino with Kit Hogg.
Hello, good morning and welcome En Camino with me, Kit Hogg, and with Janie Jewson.
Oh, very weary Janie Jewson,
yes,
too.
Yes, you do look a bit pasty, darling. What's going on?
Thank you, darling. Well, bad night, hot, too hot, but I'm getting air conditioning.
Right. So it's about the heat.
It's about the heat, Kit.
Yeah, there's got to be a knack for sleeping in the heat. Maybe we'll cover that on a future programme. But for today, we're too busy because we've got loads to talk about. We hope we find you well on this high summer Saturday, the 18th of July. On the menu today, The Fallen King, from monumental achievements to indulgent obsession, King Juan Carlos of Spain's tale of self-destruction, revealed in a new biography by Sir Paul Preston, via a hard-hitting social media post from Tracy Parker, who's scheduled to be with us in person next week. Janie introduces us to a new approach to the wildfires of summer. Plus, the Colorado housemaid arrested for stealing valuable koi carp from her boss's pond. The invisible librarian of Buenos Aires. Do you have a terrace or a patio garden, I wonder? If so, is it too hot to pot? On the part of the show we call Things That Grow, we compare traditional earthenware flower pots with their plastic counterparts. And ask any historian worth his salt, who were the three colossi of ancient Mediterranean? And they would probably answer Alexander the Great, Julius Caesar, and Hannibal. Although famed for his audacious crossing of the Alps with the elephants, Hannibal spent much of his life here in Iberia. And thus we welcome him to the show in the personification of Giles Brown, who tells us this week's story of Spain. As ever, an eclectic mix, a random assortment, a curate's egg, your Saturday supplement, live here on TRE.
En Camino with Kid Hogg.
And let's go straight to Hannibal, Giles. It's very nice of you to join us, man.
Yes, it took me ages to get here. I was too busy arranging my elephants in the car park.
Right. No, I thought you might be going into sort of some unlimited fight night or...
Something like that, no.
A Mason's Lodge. Or being a celebrant or something like that. But here you are...
Combining both.
With your historical hat on, your historian's hat on.
Right. Now, for those of you with a nervous disposition, all right, stand back because I'm about to go off on one again. If you caught my treatise on the Invisigoths, the Spain's,
yes,
last time.
Buckle up.
Because you see, the thing is, right, deep breath, here we go.
Mate, can I ask? Can I start with a question?
Yeah.
Right, I don't know if this is where you were planning to start, but
I don't know.
We're talking about a guy who was around 2,200 years ago.
Yes.
So, paint the world. What was sort of world did he grow up in? What were the geopolitics of the Mediterranean at that time? Ready, steady, go.
Right then. So we're starting. Basically, the thing is, okay, and you might want to slow this down on the playback. So the thing is, we're looking at steady. The thing is, she got up too early for this. The thing is, we look at history from the wrong point of view, okay? Because I've always looked at it from our part of the world, from Northern Europe, okay? Wrong. If you look at, and also we look at the Mediterranean as it sort of stops just at Sicily. We don't look very often at what's going around the whole basin, if you like.
So you mean the east?
I mean the east, and I mean the over there, he said, pointing out the window. The North African coast, right? Really, really, really important because people don't say, you know what, I think I'll go through the difficult way through the then Balkans, Macedonia, etc., and get to wherever. They go the south route. So the three main players at this time we're talking about, okay, are Macedonia, i.e. Alexander, his lot, okay? Mm-hmm. Right. We have the Romans, and what have the Romans ever done for us? Let's not even go there. But we have my favourite people of the whole world in any time of history. If I have a time machine, that is where I'm going. We are talking Carthage. Now,
Why? Well, what's particularly appealing
because
about
Carthage? Because there is so much about Carthage.
It's a good music scene, Josh.
It's a great music scene, exactly. No, the thing is, as you may or may not know, history is written by the victors normally, okay? And Carthage has been more maligned, more taken down, because they get wiped off the face of the earth by those Romans. Okay, I'm not a big fan. Rome exists always in a state of war. That is their raison d'etre, okay? So, we have, at around about 3rd century BCE, as we now call it, we have the three main powers.
Just break you off there. What's the E stand for?
I don't know.
Right, before Christ.
It's for somebody, yeah. It's BC,
Yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Before Christ, whatever. Well, yes, indeed. Well, they did, I mean, this will come on to woke Carthaginians as well, so here we go. So, do you know about the Phoenicians? What do you know about the Phoenicians?
Not a great deal.
Right,
were they from the Levant?
Correct.
Lebanon.
Yeah. There he goes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, Phoenicians, and we're talking Tyre, as in Tyrian, okay?
Yeah.
So, Phoenicians, sea people, all right? Phoenicians go off in 500 to 1,000 years BC, we'll call it BC because we're friends, and they go off and they are seafaring people. They are brilliant, and they start making little city-states, not countries, but they make this port system, right? So they've got one in Sicily, they've got one here, they've got one there, they've got Marseille, oldest city in the world. They've got Gades. What is Gades?
Gades is Cadiz.
Correct, 3 points. So, therefore, they've got a whole system of little trading ports, if you like, yeah? They're walled, you can't get on them, but they allow you to set up systems of trade.
Trade, yeah.
Those are the Phoenicians.
Trading slaves and spices.
Spices, slaves, whatever. The Phoenicians are brilliant, but they're really good sea people, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And they are not conquering things. They're not interested in conquering. Conquering means an army, and armies are difficult because you have to go back and get the harvest, remember. There are no standing armies, okay? Apart from the Romans when they get everybody in there, right? This will come into important about Carthage as well. So, Dido. Yeah, huge singer from the... Not only did Dido had a huge number of couple of singers, including Night, White Flag and I Can't Sleep, but she also founded Carthage in her spare time. The theory, though, if you look into antiquity, Dido is supposed to have formed, and there's a brilliant story about... She has to flee from Tyre with the remainder of her family, because most of them are getting wiped out. There's been a usurping, okay? And basically, she rocks up in Carthage. Now,
she's a Phoenician.
She's a Tyrian,
right?
A random Phoenician. I mean,
she's from a royal family. Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
And they go with all the gold, and the boats are laden down with gold. Yeah, uh-huh. But every time they pull into a port, they have to. This is legend, by the way. Just quickly, they have to give more and more gold. They end up in what is now Tunisia, right?
Yeah,
and that's, if you look at Tunisia on a map, it's the Tunisia goes, and this will work well.
It's like a shoulder, isn't it?
And then it goes like that, and Sheila ends up on the top bit, right there,
right.
But it's got a natural bay. She does a deal, which is brilliant. We'll do a legend the other day, but she founds, apparently, Carthage. So, back to where we are now, say 400, 300 BC, okay? Carthage is now a Mediterranean superpower for the Phoenicians, because the Phoenicians have become the Carthaginians, if you like. Carthage, they're not separate people. Yeah,
well, Carthage is a long way from Tyre, where they originated from.
Yeah, but they're sailors. They're brilliant sailors.
So they've kind of evolved.
They've evolved.
Yes, into a different...
It's like Italian-Americans.
A different mob. Yes.
Right?
Yes,
okay, so
absolutely.
They will get that. You know, they've still got Hark back, but you know, we're Tyrian, but they are in fact Carthaginian. And they've taken all their gods with them at the same time, but, you know, Baal and Marduk and all that stuff.
Right.
So, Carthage is literally a catapult's throw, a big one, from Sicily. Sicily is vitally, vitally important. Sicily is also city-states as well. Syracuse, Archimedes, Eureka, that's where he's from, right?
Right, okay.
And that's Greek.
So we're talking pre-Roman at this point.
No, Romans are the new kids on the block.
Okay, they are the new kids on the block. Right, that's important.
They've just trampled on the Etruscans.
Right.
Ouch. And they are now expanding, because Rome only exists in a state of war. That's the only reason they're so-and-sos that they are.
Right.
Okay? So, therefore...
It's important to realise.
No,
it's important to realise, Giles, that Rome in its early stage was not. It didn't encompass the whole of Italy.
There were plenty of tribes around Italy.
Italy was not unified under the yoke of Rome.
When we come on to Spain, which we will do very quickly, there's no such thing as central government. I mean, you have tribes, you have, and they're all revolting and they're joining each other and the whole thing. So, for example, you know. So Carthaginians, because of their Phoenician background, right, they are brilliant sailors. So they are the whale. Roman Empire, as it's expanding, they become the elephant. The British were the whale. Napoleon in the Napoleon Wars, the French were the elephant.
Yeah,
because they were great. They were great. So Carthage has very few people. This is their problem. They're a city-state with land outside, fabulous walls, three systems of walls around Carthage itself. It's the most amazing port, right? Mm-hmm. It's got a harbour that's got literally 200 warships being built, and these are galleyed warships.
Just to break in here, have you been there? Does it still exist?
No.
Is there any remnants of Carthage Tunisia?
They are finding them, excuse me.
Are you eating a mint?
Yeah, because of my breath. Anyway, I've got elephant breath this morning. So, you want to find out about Carthage? You have to snog it up.
Just sleeping around in the chair here.
Because I'm really... No, so, Carthage... Right, so... spoiler alert, Carthage gets destroyed in a huge way, right? By Scipio Africa. Well, by...
Okay, so, yeah, but that's much later.
It's... Well, right, so Carthage itself is this brilliant port, okay? You sail in through the gates of Carthage, you know, come in by water, right? Mm-hmm. And you would go straight in... The port itself is like an oval shape, and onto there's a commercial port, and then there's a massive military port behind another set of gates, right? And in the centre of it, like a man-made island, is like air traffic control for the pilots. Not pilots, but the pilot boats. Mm-hmm. So they are S-hot in terms of sailing. Nobody can beat the Carthaginians on the water. It really is quite something. But the only downside is they'll find out when Carthage gets destroyed, right, literally, is the fact that the main market square is right on the edge of the water. So if you get in and then you get in, because then the market square goes all the way up to the top of Carthage, because it's on a hill, mm-hmm. which is where the main Carthaginian temple is and the royal palaces and the whole thing there. Other thing Carthage has, multi-story buildings. Carthage used to build 12-story high buildings. And also, Carthage wore long trousers. Carthaginians are the guys who wear, they're not into those sort of togas that the Greeks and the Romans like wearing. They like to wear baggies, which is quite, I find it absolutely hysterical.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Right.
So, thing is, Carthage needs mercenaries.
Because it's not a lot of people.
Yeah, because it's not a lot of people. Right. So they have to pay. But luckily, they got good relations, because they're traders, they've got good relations with everybody else around the area.
Right.
People would rather trade with you than go to war with you, basically, if you can find some sort, if you're good diplomats. So... Rome, it all kicks off around Sicily, all right? So Greek power is waning, yeah? Romans invaded. So Carthage has got basically west of Sicily, right? The Greeks have got Syracuse, another amazing... Archimedes has done... Archimedes, him in the bath.
Where is Syracuse?
Syracuse, southeast of Sicily, right? Rome is expanding, gets to the Straits of... You know, as we said, because it's not all Italy at that time, gets to the Straits of Messina, yeah, which is that little bit between Sicily and Rome, mm-hmm. Italy, mm-hmm. crosses over, all what's it breaks out.
So you've got three competing powers. For Sicily.
Yeah. Greece gets a really well-known general who you will have heard of, but you won't know how brilliant it was, because he's Pyrrhus, right?
I haven't heard of Pyrrhus.
You've heard of a Pyrrhic victory, haven't you?
Yes, I have.
So that comes from Pyrrhus.
Okay, so Pyrrhus is specialised in Pyrrhic victories.
Yeah, he's a dude. Right, so basically what happens is the Carthaginians... They managed because they've got mercenaries and the Romans have got citizen army, they find themselves getting defeated by the Romans. Syracuse falls as well to the Romans horrendously. Archimedes is killed, not in his bath, but he's killed in the defense of Syracuse. And as reparations from this shattering victory, the Romans get hold of one of the Carthaginian ships and copy it. So, and then they go off and learn it in the particular Roman style. So they now have a fleet. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Two, there are Treaty of Versailles-like terms in this one, right? So you can't have this, you can't have that, you can't have that. You certainly can't have a fleet anymore, yeah? And we're going to restrict you to what you can possibly do. Oh, yeah, okay. And they have to pay huge reparations. Now, one of the guys, and then they have to go back to Carthage, obviously the Carthaginians. Now,
so they're expelled from Italy?
Oh, yeah.
Right,
okay. Sicily.
Sicily.
Right. Yes. And also Sardinia, because they've also got, again, trading ports. Yeah,
right.
So they've gone. They've gone from But Spain hasn't been touched because nobody knew that Spain.
Has the navy survived?
Well, Carthaginians, yes. They can't have more than about 30 ships
because of this treaty with the Romans.
Correct. So what then happens is they all trudge back across the short bit of the Mediterranean back to Carthage. In the meantime, the mercenaries have come with them. They get a bit upset because they ain't got paid because Carthage got no money because they had to pay huge reparations. So there's this horrendous rebellion by the mercenaries who are in Carthage, and there's a general called Hamilcar, right?
Yeah.
This isn't what looks Luke Skywalker, Mark Hamill drives. This is, in fact, a well-known Carthaginian general, and he will be...
A spoiler alert, he has three sons.
Yes.
Hamilcar.
Yeah.
And the eldest of whom is... We finally got round to mentioning...
Louis Armstrong.
Hannibal.
Correct. So he puts down this revolt, and trust me on this one, you don't want to be on the losing end of anything in the ancient world. Ooh, up the bum, the whole thing.
They were
right?
Horrible.
They were horrible. It was not good, but these mercenaries were pretty
hundreds
horrible.
Hundreds of people crucified.
Hundreds of people crucified, yeah, because they were the first to evolve.
They weren't particularly...
Anyway.
Stay on the right side of them.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, but in the meantime, politics is very... Because Carthage doesn't have a king. There's no Carthaginian king. It's got two leaders.
Like the Romans had two consuls.
Exactly.
Right.
So there is a system, but they're much. You see, Carthage is really because it's trade based. Mm. They've got people coming up from Mali with gold. They've got people coming in from the Silk Roads. They've got Numidian horsemen thundering across. They've got Berber. They've got the whole.
So it's quite transactional.
They're traders.
It's sort of like Trump, really. Trump administration.
Without
Trump.
The Romans are Trump. Yeah. Trumpers are the Romans.
Right.
Yeah?
Except that they also had consuls, didn't they?
At this time.
They didn't have an emperor.
No, true. But they would. Yeah. They would.
This is a very old system.
So basically, where are we? Oh, blimey. Right. Just quickly. So, Hamilcar has to...
No, it's too good to compress.
Hamilcar defeats the mercenary army.
Yeah, yes.
They're all hanging around with spikes up their bums or whatever. And, however, because politics is politics, like we just said 30 seconds ago, there's some mutterings in the Carthaginian camp. So he thinks, I'm going to get out of dodge here, all right? So he decides to cast his eyes over, and he decides to go over and have a look at Spain, because he...
Hamilcar. Okay. Father of Hannibal.
Exactly. And...
What was the motive for that?
The motive was there's mutterings in the Carthage, because the Carthage are always having new consuls or new whatever, tribunes or whatever. So he wants to get him and his sons out of Carthage.
Okay.
If he's the wife. And also, they're being hamstrung, but he knows that there are resources in Iberia, in Spain.
Yes.
So, because they're not allowed to, apparently, in Carthage is being watched by the Romans. So if you say, what are you doing over there? Oh, that's just a little yacht I'm building for myself at the weekend. So if they see anything that looks like military rearming, they'll come down and they'll absolutely dump on them from a huge height, and that's a technical...
Again, like Trump and Iran.
Please,
I'm interested in how the Romans would survey Carthage at such distance.
This is one of the great misconceptions, right? We think these powers just are in... All ancient powers, you think they're in slabs of stone. They are mingling all the time. People are travelling. They've got, you're on the great trade route as well. When we get to the elephants, this will blow your mind, where they come from, for example. So... The Romans can keep their eye on stuff. The distance between Sicily, which is now Roman,
yes,
and Tunis is nothing, or Carthage, is nothing. Right.
Okay.
So Hannibal goes across, but he decides to take your kid to work date on that particular day in Carthage, because his son, Hannibal, one of his sons, who is nine.
Yes.
Right. And he also takes his other son, he's got another son called Mayo, and he's also got a son called...
Mago, I think it's
Mago,
called Mago,
thank you,
not,
yeah.
Mayo.
Mayo. And he's also got a son called Hasdrubal.
Right, yes.
Right,
so... there's three sons.
And
they must have been tiny, the little ones.
Hannibal's nine.
Yeah, and he's the eldest. So Mago and
are younger than nine. Well done.
Yeah.
So,
that's kind of a father thing, isn't it? I mean,
It's the ultimate lad. It's the ultimate lad. His dad trip, isn't it?
But he must have had...
You took Coy to go and see, I don't know, so-and-so plays Richmond rugby, and he decides to take his young boy, his young lad. Imagine you as Hamilcar.
Three of them less than 9 years old.
Exactly.
They're just going to go and conquer Spain.
Yeah.
You know?
You see, that's the thing. He's not going to conquer... But first of all, he makes Hannibal swear a solemn oath that he will always hate the Romans.
Yes, on a sacrificial altar or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm not quite sure what they were sacrificing, but it was some sort of altar.
All right, that's another great... Anyway, that's Roman propaganda. So
Charlesy, that's not just a trading thing, is it?
What?
That embedded hatred of Rome.
Oh, no. Yeah, they've been emasculated. In the same way that the Germans are after Versailles, they are emasculated.
Yes.
And there's a lot of things. Right, so basically what happens is, long story short, Hamilcar, Hasdrubal, Mayo, and
Hannibal,
they all land in Iberia. Now, they take the ports first. They take the coast. They're not interested in going inland. Most important of this is going to be around the silver mines, which are up on the southeast coast, and they of Spain, all right?
Okay, right. So they land, but they land in Cadiz, don't they?
They land in Cadiz because it's a Phoenician port.
Yes.
So, hey, look, guys, hey, you know, you're from Tyre, I'm from Tyre. Hey, look at the Buster. You know,
to put the Spanish thing in context, this is where the name Cartagena comes from, doesn't it?
Right, yeah. Now, Cartagena comes from. So they're finding their way through. Some of the tribes fight. Some of the tribes go, this is quite impressive. Because, you know, the Carthaginians can still look pretty impressive with an army.
The endemic Iberians in Iberia. Yes.
He's also brought his Numidian cavalry. Basically, we are talking best horsemen in the ancient world.
Yes.
Apparently,
they didn't even use saddles.
Of course not.
Amazing.
Yeah, and they are absolutely key. But they're run, again, these are kind of mercenaries. They're getting paid. They've got their own king. He comes in. I could go on all day about this. But they it's a twofold mission. So on one half, they're going, look, if you come with us, if you provide us mercenaries, because the Spanish fighting men, the Iberian fighting men, are the, you know, some of the best in the world. They've got these brilliant javelin throwers, okay?
The short sword.
Yes. Yes,
indeed. The stabbing sword.
The stabbing sword, yes.
Charlesy, listen, man, we're not going to get this in.
I know.
And I don't want to spoil it.
All right, well.
So would you come back and, I mean, can you kind of fabricate a chapter one ending?
Okay, we are at the moment.
Within the next few minutes.
Yes, of course.
And then we can leave everybody hanging for our next instalment, because it's too good to rush. There's no way we can cross the Alps today.
Oh, we're going to try to cross the Alps. So, okay, I'll tell you.
We can't even get in the elephants.
They found the town of Cartagena, the city of Cartagena. Great port, yeah?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Cartagena comes from Cart and Hal, which is Carthaginian for new town. Carthage, Cartagena.
Okay.
It gives them the resources of the silver mines, right? Which means they can pay more mercenaries, which means you can start to build an army, all right? Also, this also means I'm going to cut it short on a sad bit, but don't worry, right? Because they are not only are they, because when you think about tribes, they're sitting around there scratching themselves and, you know, pulling woad out of their ears and whatever else. You know, there is an Iberian. This is obviously pre-Goth, but there is an Iberian, you know, system of nobility, aristocracy, if you like, amongst tribes, and so the Carthaginians are on a, if we, you know, if you're good, nice to us, we'll intermarry with you. We'll have Carthaginian families who are with us, yeah, and we will marry. So they're setting up a little system as well. So it's not just hearts and minds as well as. Mm-hmm. There are a couple of tribes who are against this. Just quickly, there are elephants with them as well. He's bought 4,000 cavalry with him, all right? Yeah, and more than half a dozen elephants. And they come from Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
They're not African elephants, yeah? They are because it's all interconnected. So they've come literally from...
North African elephants.
Yeah.
From Egypt.
Well, they're trying to work out whether... Now, that's because we never found any bones of this, but they're trying to work... There might be an extinct species of... Basically... Hamilcar has a great campaign, the whole thing. There is a battle up in northeast Spain. We're gonna pretty much keep it. I'm gonna. I'll kill it here, if you pardon the expression. There's a battle.
Is that Segunto?
No, that's in a minute. That I'll do that in part two.
Right.
Okay. They are quelling. Okay, they are quelling the another rebellious tribe. It goes really badly for the Carthaginians. Right now, Hannibal and the boys, are in their early 20s here. Right, Hasdrubal sees that there is they're in real danger, and they're going to get massacred by this tribe. Right, so he says to the boys,
Hamilcar.
Yeah. The dad says, right, the dad, that away. Right. Go that way.
Oh, yeah.
He puts on a rear guard action.
Right.
And this is proper heroic stuff.
Yeah.
And he leads his elite guard into this one bit of a river. And of course, because he's got his Carthaginian flags and whatever. I love Carthage bumper sticker, the usual stuff.
Yeah.
Dido is my soulmate. And because he's fighting against the chief, against this tribe, they all go in and attack. They let the boys and most of the army get back out of there. And Hamilcar dies the death of a hero protecting his three boys, and that is absolutely wonderful. It's a proper heroic death, last stand, etc. for Carthage and for glory. So that then leaves us with a hanging. We'll leave it there, because now the man who went into Iberia has secured the silver and the precious metals. He's got Hasdrubal, who is his brother, is his son-in-law, who's taken over. Hannibal's not on the scene yet. And this is Hasdrubal the Beautiful, or Hasdrubal the Handsome.
Oh, yeah, he was handsome.
And
yeah.
He is the one who, even further, because he's a good-looking boy, he managed to get even more intermarrying between the Iberian tribes. And there's only one big one, and we'll come on to that next time. So as the scene is set, Hamilcar is dead, Hasdrubal the Handsome is running the Iberia, and a 24-year-old Hannibal is kicking his heels, thinking, what am I going to do next?
What will happen next, Gelsey? In the meantime, you have some fan mail. I just have to... it says... It's from Angela Sharp. She says, morning you two. Wowsy, Charlesy is absolutely mind-blowing. His knowledge is unbelievably exciting. I could listen all day. We'd let him go on all day, Angela.
Yeah, talk radio Carthage.
Plus, it's a great subject I seriously want to know more about. He's missing a vocation in lecturing. I would pay to go.
So wow.
There we are, Charlesy. We'll be back in a moment with Wildfires, King Juan Carlos of Spain, and self-entitled diners in restaurants. We'll see you then.
En Camino with Kit Hogg.
Yes, welcome back. Raquel Marino from Sir News Malaga says that under the cosh of this current ola de calor heat wave, that the dates 15th of July to the 15th of August are known as la canicula. In English, we might say the dog days of summer, during which this coming week, temperatures in the south and east of Spain have topped out at 3 to 6 degrees higher than average for the time of year. I'm sure I don't need to tell you this, actually, but it's official now. Next week's guest here on En Camino is a long-time resident of Spain, writer and equestrian expert Tracy Parker, who Janie and I met on a research breakfast, didn't we, earlier this week?
We did.
Who, in the wake of the hideous wildfires in Almeria just this week, posted a brilliant piece on why we all over the Mediterranean are becoming more and more incendiary.
Absolutely. The article was really impressive. She entitled it, "You Do Not Fight Wildfires in the Summer." And she starts out saying, "I first came to Spain in 1981. For centuries, people didn't simply live in the countryside, they managed it. Now, she made friends here and got to know the countryside and the people who lived and worked in Spain around that time and beyond. She says that families regularly went into the woods each autumn to collect fallen branches, pine cones and other dead wood for their fires. They coppiced woodland using the traditional Monte Bajo system, taking only what the forest could sustainably provide. That kept the undergrowth under control, reduced the build-up of fuel for wildfires and encouraged healthy regeneration. Today, much of that simple woodland management is either prohibited, heavily restricted, or cannot be carried out without official permission." So she watched shepherds move goats through forests, scrubland, and along roadsides. The animals did what expensive machinery now struggles to do. They cleared undergrowth, reduced fire risk, maintained open habitats for wildlife, and kept roadsides and woodland cleaner and safer. But today, that way of managing the land has largely disappeared, buried under regulation, bureaucracy, and economics. Landowners are expected to maintain their land, yet many cannot remove dead trees, clear undergrowth, or cut back vegetation without permits, so environmental reports or official authorization are often needed as well.
Yeah, it'd be interesting that, isn't it? That we're basically tripping over the red tape of bureaucracy.
Absolutely.
Trying to maintain a clean and viable campo. That's her point, isn't it?
It is.
And she was brilliant when we met her, and we hope she's going to come in live next week to talk to us about fire control, particularly her life as an equestrian. And she's written a rather brilliant book for kids.
What was the title, Kick?
It was Fuego or something. It's about fire control. It's in English and in Spanish, and she's trying to market it to schools.
There was a wonderful
quote in it, or a bit I read that said, this kid saying, "Granddad, don't put your cigarette butt out of the window."
Oh, perfect. Yeah. Absolutely perfect.
Abuelo, no te pone tu colilla por fuera de la ventana.
And I think we'll hear more about that next week. I'm really looking forward to interviewing her because she's extremely knowledgeable. And having lived in the campo and sort of been around these fires that have just raged sometimes, the book is called Zappi, El Zorro de los Incendios.
Is that the book for kids?
That's right.
Okay. And she's going to tell us about that next week.
Yeah.
This little story comes from a feed that arrives in my emails it's from Isabella Montiero in Colorado. A housemaid was arrested after security cameras caught her moving nearly $40,000 worth of fish into the boot of her car.
Fish.
The homeowner... Right, so you're a homeowner and you're away from home and you receive a security alert via CCTV, opened via his phone to see footage of his maid with a fishing net carrying his very valuable koi carp.
Oh, no!
Fish, a bunch of them, out of the pond and toward her car. He's like, what is going on?
How naughty.
And he panicked. Because these fish are extremely valuable. And they were beloved. He loved them. They had names. You know, there's the gold one. He's called Goldie, etc. they're very expensive to replace.
Were they coming out? Was she taking them out in nets and in water?
No, in nets, yeah.
Oh, my God.
And moving them to an undisclosed location at this point. And when he tried to call her, she didn't answer. So he assumed the worst and called the police. And when officers arrived, they found a number of koi carp in a small tank in the trunk of her car in water. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they detained her immediately. But her story changed everything. She told the police that she was not the culprit, quite the reverse. A bear had gotten into the property, thought all his birthdays had come at once, and was feeding on the fish in the pond. So she bravely, acting instantaneously, shooed the bear away, and because her employer didn't have a reserve tank, she was rescuing the surviving carp, taking them to the taking them to a bigger tank that she had in her house.
I hope she got a reward for that.
Well, you're right, yeah, because actually initially no one believed her, and then the homeowner checked the footage, the police checked the footage, and the camera clearly showed this bear scoffing the fish.
Wow, and she just shooed it away.
Yeah, the valiant maid saved whatever she could, having shooed the bear away, and her employer apologised immediately, gave her a raise and a paid holiday. How sweet is that?
Oh, good. Yeah. Good. That was a very good... She's a very good maid.
Now, Argentina. Now, we may not be feeling very good about Argentina being English, having watched that football match the other day. Did you see that football match?
I did.
The semi-final of the...
They were very rough, weren't they?
Yeah, I thought they deserved to win. I thought they were actually brilliant, Argentina, once they stopped fouling and decided to play football. But here's a different side to maybe the sort of pugnacious militancy of Argentinians that we might be stuck with in that image. Paco Serra writes in El País that in Buenos Aires, a city with 400 bookshops, lives a tremendously literary fellow. His name is Roque, though almost everyone calls him Tigre because of the tiger he has tattooed on his back. Now, Tigre is an avid reader. He's also a street animal with a rough past, and today he drives a cab. And what's notable about him is that every time he finishes a book, he devotes himself to the same ritual. He closes it, wraps it in a polythene bag, takes paper and pen, and writes a note like this. I leave you this book so you can learn something. It might be the only book you ever read in your life, but you will be able to say, I read a book. And then without signing the note, Tigre drives in his taxi along the long, narrow streets of Buenos Aires barrio, finds a table, you know, one of those with cement benches around it, and sets the book down. He leaves immediately so as not to draw attention to himself. And he shares works by Borges, Neruda, Sabato, Coelho. Coelho, you've read, Paul Coelho, and he's been doing it for some 40 years now. Books that possess the capacity to change lives, ease loneliness, arouse the unexpected, strengthen loving relationships, and save the reader from despair.
I think that's wonderful. I actually was walking through Estepona the other day and I passed a cabinet with a glass front and two little doors just standing on a post. The cabinet was on a post, not me. And inside were books which you can just share and take and exchange. No, I love that.
It's very nice, yeah. I tend to be a bit of a book hoarder, actually. If I finish a book, I tend to like to keep it because it's a bit like keeping an album. It will remind, even though you might not listen to it anymore, can remind you of a particular time of life. And there's also things in a good book that I like to go back to and refer to. But Tigre is just this guy in Buenos Aires. He says, I might just start signing the notes I leave in my books.
Yes.
And I'm thinking of signing myself as the Invisible Librarian of Buenos Aires.
Very good.
How
very
nice
good.
Is that, eh?
That's very nice. I've taken to actually writing a note describing what the book was about and putting it inside the book so that I can remember, because quite often I'll look at the, I don't remember titles and authors and I don't remember the content, and sometimes I'll pick up a book, start reading it and realise I've already read it.
Oh, really, Jamie?
Yes,
not what, then you fell asleep while you were reading it.
No. I just read them so fast and I just cast them aside and start another one. Anyway, moving on.
Yeah, moving on. Just to enhance the historical theme on today's programme, this story, much more recent than Hannibal. It's not that we actually got to Hannibal this time, but we will be getting to Hannibal. It's told by the Hispanophile Paul Preston. Paul Preston, renowned for books such as The Spanish Civil War, The Last Days of the Spanish Republic, Gente Traicionado, A People Betrayed, Franco, a biography. He's written so many books about Spain. And he's just published a new one, and it's called The Downfall of a King, Juan Carlos of Spain. Now, we probably all remember Juan Carlos of Spain. And the book was reviewed recently by Ben Hall, the Financial Times European editor. And I think the moment that most of us will remember about Juan Carlos of Spain occurred on April the 18th, 2012, when he emerged from his room in a Madrid hospital to make a statement to the nation. He said, I'm very sorry, I've made a mistake and it will not happen again. He had just been discharged after receiving a hip replacement surgery after a fall during an elephant hunting trip in Botswana. He apparently fell in the shower. Accompanying him on his lavish expedition was Princess Corina Wittgenstein, saying his longtime lover.
Goes around comes around, eh?
Yeah, so he absconded on a hunting trip.
Mm-hmm.
you know, covertly.
Yes.
And then fell over in the shower and broke his hip.
Yes. Well, not sorry,
a,
serves
not
him right.
A good look. I mean, no. The hunting trip triggered a media storm and public outcry. The global financial crisis had cratered the economy, and hard up Spaniards were incensed at their king's secret indulgence. Adding to the sense of the grotesque, a picture emerged from a previous hunting party showing him posing with a rifle next to this beautiful dead elephant.
Oh,
I mean, just
God,
so shameful.
Horrible.
But this looks like a great book, guys. It's by Paul Preston, Sir Paul Preston, and it's called The Downfall of a King, Juan Carlos of Spain. Here Preston recounts Juan Carlos' sleazy activities in almost as much detail as his political one, the dereliction of royal duties, the industrial scale of adulteries, the multiple often simultaneous lovers, trysts in the back of a van parked behind the Zarzuela Royal Palace, and his ugly breakup with his, not only his queen, but his wife, but the Princess Corina. All this having saved the Spanish constitution after the attempted coup in 1981. I mean, really an interesting life from the ethereal heights to the pits.
Are you going to get that book, Kit?
Yes, I will, I think.
Well, after you.
All right, Jenny.
I'll give it back, I promise.
Okay, goodness me, look at the time. We're going to have another break now, and we'll be back with Things That Grow. We'll see you after this.
En Camino with Kid Hogg.
I'm loving the barking dog.
All right, just gorgeous.
Is that Silvo, the whistling? Is that Silvo, the whistling in La Gomera, or is it a?
It's a knife sharpener.
Knife sharpener.
And this is a sound that I picked up in the silence of the heat in Estepona only last week.
Oh, great, great. It's still happening, yeah?
Just gorgeous. Yeah. And it's, I don't know, I find it haunting and very special somehow.
Was he on a bicycle?
He was on a bicycle. Yeah. He's got his turning wheel, his sharpening wheel on the back.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't see anybody come out of their house and say, oh, come and sharpen my knives.
Okay. But, okay, I would. I would definitely do that. Yeah. I really like sharp knives.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, what I hate are blunt knives. And
yes.
Have you tried to cut a tomato with a blunt knife?
Oh, tomatoes are so difficult with that sharp. Yes.
And all over you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so. Anyway, I love that sound. So there we go.
Yeah, thanks for that, Jenny. A bit of live street life from Barcelona. It's time for this. Yeah, we know what this is. It's time for the part of the show we call Things That Grow. Now, short, sharp heat. We don't have a short, sharp heat, but long-term heat. It's a long-term shock to gardeners. Investors will remember Warren Buffett's famous remark about a sharp shock in stock markets. He says, you can only find out who's been swimming naked when the tide goes out. Well, in gardens, you find who has been planting thoughtlessly when the heat soars. It exposes carelessness about containers and what goes in them. But first, a word about pots.
Yes,
flower
tell us
pots,
about pots.
Janie.
Yes, tell us about pots.
Well, this is a very interesting distinction, and one that kind of I knew in deep down, but I never had articulated. Mm. Plastic pots, the difference between plastic and earthenware.
Well, the earthenware ones, they're breathable, aren't they? Because the actual clay will hold the moisture, or does it
absolutely
let it go?
You got it in one, yeah. Plastic pots predominate because you can buy big plastic pots that look like earthenware pots. They're a lot cheaper. They're a lot lighter.
Yep.
And they're sold as containers for plants for replanting, and purists object to them on strong ecological grounds because most of us still end up with them after shopping on impulse. Certainly on my patio, I've got plastic pots. But The thing about earthenware pots, as you say, is that their sides are thick enough to absorb the heat. And when they're watered thoroughly, they retain some of that moisture.
They do, in
the earthenware, you know, in the terracotta.
Well, it's more natural, isn't it?
Yeah, they look a lot
absolutely.
Nicer.
Absolutely.
Well.
What I do find amusing, though, is some people will buy these huge pots which have a turnover edge on the top to make them look pretty, you know, and maybe they're actually not earthenware raw clay. They've been fired, so they've got decoration on the outside, you know, in colour. And then they're trying to get maybe a mature yucca out of that pot. You can't do it.
You can't do it. You have
because
to break
you've got,
the pot.
Yeah, because you've got that lip over the edge.
Yeah.
Absolutely impossible.
Yeah, yeah. Or a spiky cactus is much worse. Yeah, you just have to crack that. I suppose if you put loads and loads of water in there, the soil will loosen and you will be able to pull it out. But it's not good.
You can eventually, but you damage it on the way.
So, especially if your pots are on a hard surface, like a patio, for example, don't economise with plastic. Try and get the earthenware pots. And if necessary, drive to Morocco, because their earthenware pots are super cheap. You take your car, you drive a little ways out of Tanger or Ceuta. And
load them up.
Even if you're not going any further, and it would be tempting to go further, obviously, to get the whiff of Africa. By the side of the road, there are big terracotta stores, big terracotta, like their emporiums under canvas.
Fabulous.
And we always used to bring back pots and pots of pots. So, so that's my tip for today. How's your garden going, Jenny?
My garden is quite interesting. The tomato leaves all died, but I do still have tomatoes and there's new growth, so that's good. The decapitated papaya tree, which the wind took its head off, is now looking lush. It's got an amazing amount of growth at the top of the tree, where it broke. The neck,
okay.
Yes. It's looking fabulous.
Yeah.
But my lawn is looking dreadful, Kit.
I think lawns are a luxury in this. Yeah, unless you've got loads and loads of water.
Well, I'm watering it, but it's got all these little yellow patches all over it.
Because it's dry? Because it's heat?
I don't know. I wonder if I don't know how lawns grow normally, but... I mean, you any good at restoring them?
No. The lawns are not my speciality.
Right. Well, I won't ask you then.
So no. And we've just time for a 19th century comment on Spanish gazpacho.
Ooh!
From Richard Ford, who was one of the very early travellers to this country. Mm. He made a trip on horseback, largely, in 1845. So this is ancient stuff.
I love gazpacho.
And he says, I love gazpacho at this time. And remember, we did a survey on gazpacho earlier, and Needles gazpacho came out as being the best of the pre-prepared gazpachos. But if you're going to prepare gazpacho yourself, check this out from Richard Ford, written in 1845. He says, any remarks on Spanish salads would be incomplete without some account of gazpacho, that vegetable soup or floating salad, he says, which during the summer forms the food of the bulk of the people in the torrid portions of Spain. The dish is of Arabic origin, as its name, soaked bread, implies. This most ancient Oriental, Roman and Moorish reflection is composed of
tomatoes, cucumber, green peppers, red peppers, onion, vinegar, oil, lemon juice.
Yeah, very good, Janie. Except, interestingly, he doesn't list tomatoes here.
You're joking.
Onions, garlic, cucumbers, chilies, all chopped up very small and mixed with crumbs of bread and then put into a bowl of oil, vinegar and fresh water.
No tomatoes
at this stage. We have to remember that tomato comes from North America, although it would have been around for a couple of hundred years by this stage, because that arrived in the 16th, 17th century. The tomato arrived in Europe, but maybe they hadn't become as popular as they are today.
But I could see you could make something quite tasty without them.
In Yes, yes, that is, but interesting that main colour, that main ingredient that we think of today didn't exist in his time. He goes on to say that in Andalusia during the summer, a bowl of gazpacho is commonly ready in every house of an evening and is partaken of by every person who comes in. It's not easily digested by strangers, apparently, who do not require it quite as much as the natives, whose souls are more parched and dried up and who perspire less.
Ooh.
The components, oil, vinegar and bread, are all that is given out to the lower classes of labourers by farmers who profess to feed them. Two cow's horns, the most primitive form of bottle and cup, are constantly seen suspended on each side of their carts and contain this provision with which they compound their breadcrumbs, their meagres. So you've got your cow horn with you, yeah,
yep.
And you could say, give I a dollar of gazpacho and you fill up your cow horn and then drink it.
I did have some gorgeous gazpacho in Madrid with the Spanish family. I remember when I was about 15 or something, we turned up, we were doing an exchange of flats, and there was this glorious bowl of gazpacho pre-prepared by the...
Was that the first gazpacho you ever had?
I think it probably was. Fantastic. It was outrageously delicious.
Right. Well, on that outrageously delicious note, we have to wish you all a very happy weekend. It's been lovely having your company. Thanks to our resident historian, Giles Brown, for the first in our instalment of Hannibal. We'll keep that compact next time and try and actually get on to the elephants crossing the Alps.
Is that possible?
But that will be probably in 3 or 4 weeks from now. So until then, have a wonderful weekend and we'll see you next week.
Take care, everybody.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this programme, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.